The opinions expressed by guests on Rathbones Inspired Minds are personal and will not necessarily reflect the views of Rathbones Investment Management, nor will they constitute a recommendation or advice to buy or sell any product or service on behalf of Rathbones Group PLC.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I'm Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by a former University Challenge winning captain who is now Director of Education at No More Marking. She works closely with schools in the UK, Australia and USA on developing new approaches to pupil assessment and on applications of artificial intelligence in the classroom. Before that, she was head of assessment at ARC Schools, a network of academy schools, and she's taught English in two London comprehensives, as well as been part of the UK government commissions on the future of teacher training and assessment. She is the author of three books about education, but I Can't Stop Thinking About VAR is her first book about football and will be published in November 2024. Welcome to Inspired Minds, Daisy Christodoulou.
Hi, Dan. Great to be here.
Oh, it's lovely to have you. Absolutely marvellous. Now, at the start of every episode of Inspired Minds, I have warned you of this. It's called Inspired Minds for a reason. We are exploring inspiration, the value of it, what it means to you. And we have had a whole bunch of different responses. For some people, it's sort of the cornerstone of their creative process. For some people, it's almost an impossible question to answer. So what is inspiration for you, Daisy?
I suppose when you say that word to me, you think of sort of people in history having great breakthroughs, you know, great scientific minds or creative minds having great breakthroughs. I personally find those tales of inspiration quite inspiring myself. And then I suppose in your own personal life, I'd almost link inspiration with motivation. It's maybe the things that inspire you to keep going a bit longer, to want to push through and see if you can make something work, those kind of things. So that's what I think of when I think of inspiration.
Is it for you sort of eureka moments of unlocking a puzzle? The very word eureka is about inspiration, isn't it? Archimedes jumps in a bath and apparently water topples over. He goes, eureka. Do you get those moments like Newton and the apple?
I think those eureka moments that you talk about, Newton, the apple, Archimedes, what I find really interesting about those is they get remembered by history as the moment. And often we think about inspiration as inspirational moments. I think the thing I'm also really interested in my research as well and in my day job is, are those moments of inspiration, are they really moments or are they actually the product of a lot more? So that is a really interesting debate in the literature on scientific breakthroughs or whatever, or creative moments. Maybe even the people who have the breakthroughs might remember them as a moment. And it's obviously much easier for us to remember it as Newton's moment with the apple. But actually, are they the product of years and years and years of quite boring toil and moments in studies and dead ends, but you remember the moment?
Look, I think we're going to have to dive straight in that case, to one of the things that defines you, in the public consciousness at any rate, not the University Challenge, we'll come to that later, but you wrote a book, Seven Myths, The Seven Myths of Education, and in it, there is a real focus, I think, on this difference between skills and knowledge, if there is a difference, if there is any dichotomy between them. And because of the way you're describing inspiration there, that feels like the perfect jumping off point for this, because you're almost sort of suggesting that maybe inspiration is years and years and years of knowledge accumulation. In much the same way, would it be fair to say that you say that skills and knowledge don't work in separate silos, but that skills are the manifestation of the knowledge that is taught to you?
Definitely. And I think that's why when you talk about the inspirational moment, I do get a little bit uneasy, because it probably isn't the moment. The moment is the product of years. And you're absolutely right. So my take on skills and knowledge is that skills, there is a bit of a false dichotomy there, but perhaps not in the way that people think. So skills, if you think of any skill, so perhaps being able to read, that's a skill. Obviously, mathematical problem solving, that's a skill. Any of the skills that you use in everyday life, in your job, all of those skills, my argument is, are the product of the accumulation of knowledge and the accumulation of sub-skills. So the way you acquire a complex skill isn't to just really focus on that skill. It's to try and break it down into its constituent parts. And a lot of the time when you break the complex skill into its constituent parts, those parts look like knowledge. So reading's a really good example. reading is a skill that most of us, if we're adults, we don't really think about. We read very fluently, very easily. It's dependent on the knowledge of how letters make sounds. It's also dependent on the knowledge of what words mean, of vocabulary. So if you don't know what the words mean in a passage, you're going to really struggle to be able to read. So yeah, when you break down a lot of complex skills, even if you don't realize it, they're often made up of knowledge and of sub-skills. And I think the same is true when I said, yeah, of inspiration, of discovery. Louis Pasteur had a great line on this, where he said, discovery favors the well-prepared mind. So if you have a mind that's stocked full of knowledge and full of all these skills, and then something like an apple falling off a tree does happen, you are more likely to have an insight. Apples have been falling off trees for years. People have been watching them. They didn't come up with Newton's theories. So yeah, that's the kind of link, I think, between knowledge and skills, maybe between discovery and preparation. Yeah, all of that.
So why do you think that there has been this tension between how you teach those two things? Now I talk to somebody who was brought up by an educator, a head teacher in a comprehensive school, who spent an enormous amount of time over breakfast tables and dinner tables getting frustrated with teaching methodologies. And this was 50 years ago. And it seems to me that I'm hearing the same sort of conversations taking place, which, put simply, I think would be, it's bad to teach people lots and lots and lots of facts. It's better that people work things out for themselves and do lots of, you know, project and learn through play and things like this. And this drove my father insane. I'm not sure if it's driven you insane, but you certainly address it. Why is there a tension in education between these things? Because the way you sort of describe it is that there doesn't need to be any tension. We've got a kind of category error when we're talking about them.
Yeah, Dan, I only learned this morning that your father was a comprehensive head teacher. So I've been very intrigued to hear more about him. I think, you know, you're saying your dad was having these arguments 50 years ago. And I think you're right. These arguments go back a long, long way. They at least go back to Rousseau. You can argue they go back to Plato, to Socrates, to the ancient Greeks. I think the big difference that's happened in the last 50 years, and this is what I try to do in my book, is we have a lot more evidence now about the way the human mind works. So we have a lot more research, a lot more data. And I think that, I hope, will help to settle some of these perennial arguments. So you can certainly, I was reading something recently from the 1890s, having a very similar debate about this, but there was very little sort of data that you could use to shed a light on it. We have more data now, we have more insights. And what all the insights are showing is that the really crucial thing is the relationship between working memory and long-term memory. Okay. That's the crucial thing that really proves the importance of knowledge and why we have to teach knowledge. And so it's not about a sort of ideology. It's not about politics. It's about, how does the human mind work? What are its constraints? And one of the biggest constraints is working memory. We can only get a few things into and out of working memory. Working memory is limited to about 7 things at any one time. And your working memory is anything you're thinking about right now. Okay, you can equate it with consciousness. So if I say to you, what's the capital of France? Paris is going to pop into your head. And Paris wasn't in your head a few seconds ago. So what happened is there was a cue in your environment, and that cue allowed you to pull something up from long-term memory into working memory. And that happened very smoothly, because I'm going to guess you know the capital of France is Paris. And maybe it wasn't just the word Paris. Maybe it's a few things associated with Paris. You know, the Eiffel Tower, or whatever, the Champs-Élysées. So the problem is that that working memory is limited to about 4 to 7 new items of information at any one time. And you can test that, because when you try and remember a phone number, do you often feel you run out after about 4 to 7 numbers, right? Yeah. We all do it. Yeah. And that is your just classic illustration of the limitation of working memory. So when you look at like that, working memory, absolutely puny, rubbish. But then the next question is, well, how are human beings capable of things like, yeah, you know, Newton's theories or whatever, if we've got such a puny, limited working memory? And the answer is, we use long-term memory to shortcut, to cheat the limitations of working memory. So long-term memory is vast. You can store thousands, tens of thousands of items of information in your long-term memory. And then when you use those, they don't place the same burden on working memory. So I talked before about reading. When you're reading, and you know this, you know, if anyone's ever worked with children who are learning to read, reading is such an effort for them, because every step they have to think about, every step is imposing a load on working memory. As an adult, you read fluently, it's just a habit, it's become automatic. And that's because you're relying much more on long-term memory. And reading's a great example of that. And what I would say to adults who are very good at reading is imagine what it's like when you're reading in a foreign language, how hard that is, how effortful, how everything is a strain. And you have to constantly be thinking, oh, what's that word? What does that word mean? How does that link to that? Oh, this sentence is very long. That's what it's like when you're using working memory. When you're reading in your native language, you're a good reader. That's what it's like when you're relying on long-term memory. It's just much easier, much smoother process. So what this means for education is we have to help students get as many things into long-term memory as possible, because that's what cognition is. So it's not enough to say, oh, well, you know what? If I give them the skill of analysing, I can get them to analyse a text about, I don't know, the causes of the First World War, and then they can analyse the causes of any war. Well, no, you have to know the details of the particular war, the particular historical event. It's not enough to just say analysis is this all-purpose skill that you can teach and just transfer across. What we, again, all this research shows is that skills like analysis, problem solving, they're domain specific, which means they really depend on specific bits of knowledge. And so you've had a big idea in the last 20 or 30 years about transferable skills. Unfortunately, there's no evidence that really we can transfer skills in that way. So my favourite example of this is I always think when people talk about problem solving as a skill, and I hear people say, oh, problem solving is the skill you're going to need in the 21st century. I always say, well, you know, there are people who are great at problem solving in physics and terrible at problem solving in their own marriage. The two are not transferable. So, yeah, I think go back to your original question, what's different now from when your dad was arguing about these things? I think what's different is we have more evidence, but I think that evidence shows your dad was right.
So, I mean, I suppose one of the things that comes immediately to mind there is I suppose you can monitor, say, somebody learning Japanese or Mandarin.
Yeah.
Who comes from a European environment, you know, with the alphabet that we use. I guess they're not just learning a language, are they? When they're having to learn the script, they're having to learn a whole new series of shapes.
Absolutely.
Is that the kind of research that you do to prove these?
There is a lot of work on language learners. Yeah. So language learners in a number of different ways are really fascinating for education researchers, and in all kinds of different ways. Some of my favourite research studies, and these are ones that you might want to talk about because we said we might talk about memory. Some of my favourite research studies in education are to do with how you memorise foreign language vocabulary and how you do that efficiently and what makes it memorable and that kind of thing. There's also all kinds of things around storage strength of memory for different languages. But what you say about some languages certainly being easier to learn than others, absolutely. If you've learned English, French is easier to learn than Japanese or Chinese. I think there are sort of estimated average times it takes for a completely novice learner to learn a new language. And yeah, I think Japanese, Chinese, Korean are right at the top end of that. Whereas, you know, other languages that clearly have more overlaps of English and share an alphabet are much closer. Likewise, if you can speak French, then moving to Italian and Spanish is simpler. And I think to go back to the transfer point I was making earlier, that's the difference between near transfer and far transfer. Near transfer is when there's sort of related things. You can use the skills you've got to bridge and it will help you get to the new thing. But far transfer, when you're going from something completely different, that's really, really hard, if not impossible. So when people talk about very, very vague abstract skills like problem solving, that's the problem I have with them. Like, sure, if you're a problem solver in mathematics, can you move over and solve a problem in physics? You can give it a really good go and you might have a bit of success, sure. If you're a problem solver in maths, as I say, and you're trying to then solve a problem in someone else's marriage, does that work? So all of these things, you've got to look at the relationship with different disciplines, different subjects, the texture, the content matter, that matters. You can't just junk that. You can't just say, oh, we forget about that and we can just have these abstract skills. That's not how it works.
So why does it cause so much tension, though? Because there are a few things that seem to get people more angry. It's almost as if it's you're almost taking a political viewpoint. That was where it always felt to me, that teaching knowledge was a right-wing thing to do and teaching problem-solving is a left-wing thing to do, you know?
Absolutely. As I say, there is a political and ideological tension at the heart of it, and I will come to that. But what, as I'll say is I think a lot of people having those political and ideological arguments on both sides don't necessarily realise where the science has gone and that the science is resolving some of these questions. So my hope is they were political and ideological arguments often are very hard to resolve either way. But when you can bring some research to bear, sometimes they are easier to solve. But why are they political? I think at their root, I mentioned Rousseau. I think at their root, a lot of the debates about should you teach knowledge, should you teach skills. There's also debates about should you teach facts or should you, you know, just get the students to discover them, discovery learning. These are at root romantic ideas that would, I would say, go back all the way to as I say, if not before, but at least go back to Rousseau and, you know, kind of the Enlightenment and that. And the reason they become political and ideological at their heart is because perhaps people don't want to believe in that romantic ideal of children being born with everything they need and you don't need to put stuff in, that putting stuff into them somehow feels cruel. It feels like an imposition. And we kind of want to believe in this naturalist idea. You know, it's when people talk in a number of different ways where they talk about natural, and natural is always used as a synonym for something good and wholesome and lovely. But when you think about it, is Mother Nature always lovely? Are natural forces left unchecked by civilization always beautiful and wholesome? Not necessarily. So I think these are perhaps a perennial argument within society. It's been going back for hundreds of years that people feel uneasy maybe about telling kids stuff. But what I'm trying to say is, let's park some of those political issues, ideological issues. Let's look at what the science is telling us. Let's look at what the working memory, the long-term memory. Let's look at the structures and limitations of our brains. We just have to know facts if we want to be able to think. So I often say I share a lot of similar goals to romantics. I want students to be creative and independent. I want them to be inspired. I just think the route to getting there is different. So for me, I agree with a lot of the goals. I just want to work out the best way of getting there.
Is there a little bit that, and we know the kind of people I'm talking about, but the sort of people who went to the sort of schools that I went to and the sort of schools that prime ministers went to, that there's almost a sort of a hierarchy, if you like. If the person can stand at the dispatch box and blithely reference the Battle of Crecy, or do you know what I mean, or Agincourt or whatever, it sort of gives that person a patina of nobility and intellectualism and wisdom, and that in fact, you know, kids from less advantaged environments aren't necessarily banging out the date of the Battle of Crecy. And so this is, it almost becomes almost like an expression of class. Is there something in that?
I think there's a couple of things going on here. I think there's one thing. So Edie Hirsch is an American educationalist who's written a lot about the curriculum, and he's written a lot about cultural capital, and he's written a lot about some of the things you're talking. He's written a lot about the kind of content that needs to be on the curriculum. And he's written a lot about how that ends up being a relatively traditional, the kind of content you need on the curriculum. But the argument he makes for that isn't a kind of, again, it isn't a political argument for why it needs to be there. What he looks at is, in order to be able, so again, it's, what's your goal? What's your end goal? And Hirsch sets as an end goal, at the end of an education, we'd like students to be able to read a newspaper or read a book that's written for the general public and understand it. Is that a legitimate end goal? Yeah. What Hirsch says is that when you read, you need background knowledge and vocabulary to understand what you're reading. And Hirsch, back in the day, I think this is in the 80s, did this very interesting analysis of the New York Times. They analysed all the kind of background knowledge you need to understand a typical articles in the New York Times. And all of it ends up being relatively traditional because you need to know, you know, geography and place names and where things are in the world. You do need to have like basic contours of world history. So this is not saying necessarily you have to be experts in all these things, but to be able to read, you do need background knowledge. And we often, adults can take that for granted. Yes, there is maybe the performative use of knowledge and the performative use of cultural capital. But I think what Hirsch is saying is this stuff isn't just performative. And it isn't even just that it's a nice to have, that it's nice to be able to recite a poem. What Hirsch is saying is you need it to understand the world. You can't really engage and read and understand things unless you've got this. And I think you can push that into other subjects too. You know, you're talking about sort of history, literature. Those are the ones that tend to be most contested and fought over. But if you think about maths, the reason you have to memorize maths facts is, again, to free up the space in working memory. If you're given a complex maths problem and you don't know your times tables, it's really hard to get beyond the first step. You know, if you've got a multi-step math problem, the thing that makes it easier to solve is having being fluent with your maths facts and automating some of the steps. That allows you to see the bigger picture of it. I am keen to move away from some of these sort of politicized debates and to say, what is it you need to really understand the world and to acquire these skills, which we all think are valuable? And you do need knowledge.
I mean, I would heartily endorse that, but from my own professional environment, I've absorbed enormous numbers of facts that have got into my long-term memory. And I think, you know, we'll come and talk about this in just a moment about how it got into my long-term memory. It was through repetition. It was through the reading of wisdom, the cricketer's Bible, in effect, as a kid. And the reason why those facts are important in what I do is that in order to interpret the value of what somebody's just done in front of my eyes, I need to know exactly what that's like. Now, that doesn't mean to say that I need to know every single fact, but I need to have a sense that if this guy's just scored 200 runs in 4 hours, that feels really unusually big. And if I didn't know that that's hardly ever been done because I would have come across it before, then I wouldn't be able to give that moment the significance that it requires.
Absolutely. And Dan, what you've actually said there is absolutely spot on. It's a really good example. And it's how science works. So in science, you don't know what an anomaly or an outlier is unless you know what the norm is. Right? So if you're running a scientific experiment, how do you know if you've got something odd unless you know what normal is? How do you know, as you say, that Johnny Bairstow scoring whatever it was at Trent Bridge that time, scoring, you know, 150 off 100 balls in a fourth innings run chase, how do you know that's a really big deal? Well, because you know it's never been done before. It's an anomaly and it's an outlier. This is not typical. But to know that, you have to know what typical is. So that's a very good way of putting it. Absolutely.
Well, it seems strange to me that, because this is so the most obvious thing, but you said something a little bit earlier about as if that might be cruel to children. And this is where I wonder whether it does come back to a misreading of politics, that the sort of education that was traditional in England is associated with privilege and it's associated with boarding schools and what have you. And there's a lot of rote learning. And there's a lot of pushing things into kids. And that because the environment itself feels cruel, you know, we think about Tom Brown's school days and 1920s and that sort of thing, that ipso facto, whatever was being done in those schools was also cruel. Is that partly what's feeding this?
Yes, I think something you don't have. I mean, I work in a few different countries now. The company I work for, we don't just work in the UK. And I think there probably is something peculiar to the UK where, yeah, you have this legacy of boarding schools in particular, and often associate with a lot of unpleasantness, particularly nowadays you're getting a lot of stories of historic sexual abuse coming out. And there probably maybe is a temptation for people to say, you know, everything that happened in those schools was terrible. The thing I would say as well, though, is, you know, I'm not necessarily saying I want us to go back to some 19th century vision of schooling, because, again, the thing I'm always talking about is, well, what does the evidence show us about the best way to remember things? What does the evidence show us about memory? And I don't believe that there was a school in 1850. Well, there wasn't a school in 1850 that had access to all of that. So they might have been getting some things right, just as you do by trial and error. But it's not like, I don't go around thinking, you know what, yeah, Tom Brown's school days is the model for what a school should be. I've written, there's some really interesting stuff about the curriculum Shakespeare studied, which I think is fascinating. I'm not saying I think that's the model for what we should be doing. I think we need to be looking at the best things from the past, not just sort of throwing everything out about them. Looking at what we know from modern research and then working out what our goals are and working out an education system that will help us achieve our goals. That's what I want to get to. And that will involve some memorization. I do believe, again, all the research shows, again, of course, it helps you to remember things if you're interested in them. Of course, that matters. What's tricky is when you're starting out with students who are very young and know very little to begin with, maybe don't have many interests to begin with. That's where it's tricky, right? Of what do you do there? There's also the case that we know that there's lots of things that students aren't necessarily intrinsically interested in when they're very young, we know are going to be important for them. So we do want to have students interested in what they're learning, and that will help them learn. But we can't go to the extreme of saying they should only be learning what they're interested in at the age of 5. So it's about trying to get that balance right. And, you know, if you want to get into the weeds of talking about some of the tactics and the details of how to do that, we can do it.
I do, actually, because Inspired Minds is obviously about many things, and it's about teasing out what it is that motivates people to pursue all sorts of different careers. But also, I like to think that we can provide a bit of self-help here. And I need memory techniques. I mean, I used to make money out of taking money out of quiz machines back in the day when there were only 3,000 questions to memorize. And then, unfortunately, technology got so good that there were 100,000 questions to memorize, and that became difficult for my brain. And you've written a piece that directs its reader to a few articles about how you can improve your memory and embed your memory. Can you give us a little bit of insight into that? Because everybody needs this. Everybody needs to have a functioning memory.
And this is the thing that I am really interested into. And in a way, it's the thing that got me into education. I love this kind of stuff. And this is what I think, for me, a lot of education should be about this. And what I do find frustrating is that a lot of the breakthroughs that have been made here haven't been made by educationalists. They've been made by kind of almost hobbyists who have a really pressing need to have to remember stuff and ended up evolving their own ways of doing so. So the history of this goes back to the sort of 1890s, a German guy, Hermann Ebbinghaus. He used to test himself on how long it would take him to memorize poems, lists of foreign words, lists of nonsense syllables. He was just trying to test how long it would take. The other thing I love about Ebbinghaus's experiments is they replicate. And that's a really big thing with a lot of psychological research. Does it replicate? And what's even better is not only do they replicate, but you can try them out yourself and see if they replicate. It's pretty simple to do. And they pretty much always do, right? So if you want to try it yourself, you can do it. Ebbinghaus's big insight was the forgetting curve. And his big insight is if you learn something on day one, so you let's say you learn 100 foreign words or 100 cricket statistics, within 24 hours, you'll have forgotten, I think it's about 60%. And within a month, you'll have forgotten something like 95%. So your memory starts decaying. The minute you've learned something, you start forgetting it. And that was his first big insight, the forgetting curve, that your curve, you know, and he drew it as a curve that your memory just falls away. The next big insight is that the way to address this is to interrupt the forgetting curve. So if you learn something new, it is not enough to learn it on day one and then go away. You have to come back at regular intervals. And then this is where it gets really interesting, because what lots of people have done since is said, well, what is the optimum interval? How frequently should I come back and look at it again? And now you have lots of software you can use to do this. So what people used to do in the sort of 70s, people had the shoebox method. So if you want to learn something, you would write down all the things you want to learn on index cards, put them in a shoebox. You would go through them, remember them. You come back the next day, go through them all again. You can now obviously do it with flashcards in a piece of software. And the software can use an algorithm to work out when the best moment is for you to review it.
Wow.
And the piece of software that has got a bit of a cult following is called Anki. And Dan, I think you need it in your life, right?
Come on, tell me.
I've got it in my life. So it got really popular amongst a lot of graduate medical students and people learning also foreign languages, and particularly people who are medical students in a foreign language, because these guys have to remember vast swathes of information. And it's not enough to say, they haven't even got the time to revise. So they were all really interested in, well, how do I do this? So Anki is a flashcard app that uses a principle called spaced repetition. And the idea behind spaced repetition is you want to try and find the optimum moment to refresh your memory with something you've learned. The optimum moment actually is when you're about to forget it. That's what's going to help strengthen the memory the most. So another big insight from memory research is the act of recalling a memory actually helps to strengthen the memory. That's why tests are actually good for learning. So people sometimes say about tests, oh, you know, the test doesn't help learning. We should be focusing on the learning. Tests are a learning technique because the act of trying to remember something and drag it out of memory helps build that memory. And in fact, there's all kinds of interesting things that actually when you remember something, technically, maybe you're not even remembering what it was. You're remembering the last time you pulled it out of memory. So it can get a bit complicated. But the whole point is, Dan, when you're at a pub quiz and you're straining to remember something, that act of struggling to remember it is helping build the memory.
Brilliant.
Okay. And it's going to make it easier for you to remember it the next time. So what Anki is trying to do is to give you lots of opportunities of having that moment of pulling it out of memory to make it a habit, but also to do it in the most efficient manner. So you could say, well, I'll just do my flashcards. I'll do them all every day. But that's just unmanageable because you might have 10,000 flashcards. So what Anki is saying is you learn your first things on day one and then you come back after 2.5 days and you go through them all again. And the ones you've forgotten, you then have to review again immediately. The ones you've remembered, the time will double, maybe slightly more than double, to 5 to 7 days. So every time you get a review right, you don't have to view it again for an increasingly large period of time. But the ones you get wrong, you have to look at straight away. And then the kind of clock resets on those. So the idea is you can end up with a flashcard deck of 10,000 flashcards, and you'll maybe only have to review 20 or 30 a day to have more memorized, you know, if you build up over time. So the thing about Anki is I use Anki it is a bit like a magic trick when you get going with it. And what I mean by that is if there are things you want to remember and you do put them into Anki and you do do it, there will be that weird moment where you'll hear something mentioned on the news and without even knowing it, you'll just know kind of what it was. And Anki has the ability to do that. So I recommended it to a friend in lockdown and he used it. He's really into cryptic crosswords and he was using it for some of those sort of cryptic crossword little shortcuts that you just need to know. And he just couldn't believe how effective it was. That just there were 100 or 150 things that he just wanted to learn and he'd really struggled with it. And Anki just absolutely nailed it for him. So for things like that, it works. It also works. Do you ever have that thing where you read a nonfiction book and maybe a couple of years later you come back and maybe you reread a bit of it and you think, I have no recollection of reading that at all. And it's really good. And I wish I had remembered it because it would have been really useful. What you can do with Anki is you can put in quotes or extracts or ideas from nonfiction books. So I hate the way that you'll put a few hours into reading a book and then within a few months you can have forgotten so much of it. You know, what's the point of reading it in the first place if you're going to forget so much of it? So I will put interesting things from books I've read into Anki and then you're remembering for the long term. So there's a guy who uses Anki, he's got come up with a great phrase for it. He says, what this system does, it makes memory a choice. If you come across something and you want to remember it, he estimates it'll take 5 minutes of your life over, you know, a few years to remember it. So if you think that thing that you've just come across is worth 5 minutes of your life, you can put it into Anki and you will remember it. So that's what I love about it.
This is a great tip, but I'm going to get it. It has me in mind of, and you're an educator, of course, but it has me in mind of how the child brain operates differently. I don't know whether it's the brain operating differently or whether your societal circumstances are different. You know, you don't have to go out to work. You don't have to worry about, I mean, you might have to worry about money, but there's nothing practical you can do about it when you're 12, 13 years old. You know, I used to read and reread the things I really loved. I used to watch and rewatch. I mean, you know, I could recite whole swathes of Fawlty Towers now because I probably watched the episodes 30, 40 times. Now, when you get older, you cannot justify rewatching. I mean, I'm rewatching because my nephew's staying with me. I rewatched the last few episodes of a series, Slow Horses. And if he'd asked me before we put him on what happens in this episode, in this series, I would not been able to tell him. But then when I watched it, it came back to me. And I realized that I don't rewatch and I don't reread anymore. It's as if having done that, it feels like I've got so little time left on this earth. To spend it doing something I've already done feels heinous. So is that a problem with the physiology of the brain? Is it a problem with the fact that our lives just diminish in time and our perspective is different, the amount of leisure time we have? What is it that's happening here?
Dan, that is so interesting. I have exactly the same experience, exactly the same as you just said. And this, almost the same with Fawlty Towers as well. I've watched them so many times and can recite large chunks of them. Maybe we could do the Battle of Cressy. Cressy, yeah. Poitiers. Yeah. Dennis Compton's birthday, your cloth-eared mint. let's not do that. but exactly the same now is that, you know, anything new that I read or watch, yeah, I'd never watch or read it again because you just feel like, and is that life getting busy as you get older, as you say, you've got other priorities? I don't know. Is it something, there is some interesting bits, I'm not completely sort of up on this research. I think there are some interesting things about how early teens, perhaps we all have a thing in early teens, there is something where we are hardwired to kind of want to suck in as much information as possible. And there are some interesting evolutionary reasons why that might be the case. So there are some interesting bits there that maybe it's something natural that we want to be memorizing things in that way. I can't have this conversation without a little bit talking about the modern media environment, the impact of social media. I think one of the reasons why we would watch and rewatch Fawlty Towers is there was nothing else to watch. And now there is a just unending stream of content. So are people going to memorize things in the same way or rewatch in the same way? I don't know. And I think that there was a similar, you know, if you look at it historically, it's actually a slightly similar thing when maybe sort of 18th century, when people, it used to be, you know, books were so expensive, people only read the Bible. The Bible was their only book. And so, of course, they read and reread and reread it. And you can make the argument that a lot of religious wars are down to the fact people got nothing else to read. So they're arguing about, you know, specific bits of the Bible and words, what they mean. And as books become a bit cheaper and people can afford, you know, even more ordinary people can afford to have libraries or go to libraries, people read more, not necessarily reading more in terms of time, but they're reading different types of material and they're not just going back to the same book again and again. So there is something there about supply and demand, that if you only have one book to read, you're going to read that book over and over again. If you only have one TV series to watch, you're going to watch it over and over again. When you've got unlimited content, then as you say, watching something again or reading it again feels like a much bigger commitment, a much bigger ask. So I think there is that. And I think all the concerns we have at the moment about social media, look, I know the media environments have always changed, I've said that, but they haven't always changed for the better. And even when they have changed for the better, often there's a lot of short-term disruption while people work out the benefits of the new tools and try to mitigate what's negative. So I don't know. I suspect there's something that is just about getting older in terms of answering your question. And I suspect there's also something about the impact of new technologies.
Now, I'm conscious of time here, and I've been given a great opportunity, which I don't often get on Inspired Minds, to delve into a topic that is very close to my heart. And I know it's very close to your heart, which is sport. You absolutely love sport. I've been with you in sporting environments. I've seen the delight across your face. I've seen the furious rage as well. I've seen irrationality and rationality in equal measure. Here you are as a sort of, you know, you're an educator, you're a renowned educator, looking after the brains and nurturing the next generation. And yet you have a passion for what is essentially, it's silly, isn't it, sport. And so much of a passion that you've written a book about VAR, the video assistant referee, which also touches a little bit on cricket, because we have a similar system, DRS, and people who like tennis, they'll be familiar with Hawkeye. These are all systems of technology that have been brought in to try to solve. Well, you tell me what it's tried to solve, because actually in your book, it's very interesting that you say what people think it's trying to solve, but in fact it does in many ways the complete opposite.
Absolutely, yeah. So I've written a book about decision reviews, I guess, in sport. So it's called I Can't Stop Thinking About VAR. And what you've had in the last 20 years or so in most sports around the world is technology being used to review the decisions of the officials. You know, tennis was one of the earliest sports, perhaps one we're all familiar with Hawkeye, telling you if a ball is in or out. Cricket, DRS. So cricket, first of all, had a third umpire with a TV replay to review line run out decisions. And then you had DRS in cricket. And football was very late to the party, the biggest sport in the world, but late to the party on this. And essentially introduced it in two tranches. There was goal line technology, which is actually the same company, Hawkeye, that do tennis lines and do leg before wicket calls in cricket. They're also used for the goal line technology in football. And that came in 2013 in the English Premier League and worked pretty well. It could tell you if a ball, if it had bounced over the line, was it over the line or not? And so that was fine. That's worked pretty well. But then in 2019, in the Premier League, you had video assistant referee, which I would say has not worked well. And people are very unhappy with it. Not just fans, lots of players, managers, very unhappy with how it works.
Just to cut in there, just for the layperson, what we're describing here is two slightly different things. Because one of them is that using the judgment of the video, of replays, if you like, to be able to see what we would call a line decision. So, you know, is that bat behind the line or not? Because that determines whether somebody's out or not. Is that ball behind the line or not? So that's sort of measuring something that has happened. The problem that you identify is when you get into more interpretive situations. And I'm going to leave cricket out of this for a minute, because the predictive element of Hawkeye is a different thing. What we're talking about is where the actual imposition of VAR, video assistant referee, actually changes the game that we're watching, because it has to make interpretive decisions about rules or laws as they are in cricket. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, to be fair to football's authorities, one of the reasons they were a bit late to the party is they did realise that football has a relatively subjective rule book. So what is a foul? It's not hard and fast, as you say, in the way that a goal line decision is, or the way that is your bat across the line. The football's authorities realised that you could have one referee give a decision on an incident, another referee might give another one, and they might both be legitimate within the terms of the way the rules are defined. And probably compared to a lot of sports, football has more of those. And football's also a very fluid, fast-moving sport. It does rely on the referee sort of making these quick decisions, moving everything on. And so what you've had with football is one of the problems, I mean, there's a number of problems, but one of them is that you've got these relatively subjective decisions that, to be honest, are quite 50-50, a lot of them. and you're now just in a morass of reviewing them and watching them again, and the referee going to a monitor, everyone picking over them, and you're not necessarily any better off at the end of it than you were at the start. So if you've got a load of 50-50 calls, are you really, you know, what are you gaining with it? And the other thing you've added in, and I talk about this, is when you watch a lot of these incidents in slow motion, they're not the same anymore. So you've had a huge issue with referee, something happens in real time, looks fine, go and review it in slow-mo, all that looks terrible, ban it. But then, as you say, you are changing the game if you're refereeing it in slow motion. And to be fair, they've since put in rules about what they can and can't review on slow motion. But I think there's just been this whole set of really big, actually quite philosophical questions that nobody ever expected when they first brought in VAR.
Because of intention, isn't it? Because football had for many years this notion of intent being something that's important. Now, that seems impossible for a referee to work out, because you have to be a mind reader there. Except that you don't. And this is something that you bring up, because the easy answer would be to say, well, actually, it's just ridiculous. We should just ban it all because referees can't be mind readers. And, you know, it's changed the handball law such that, you know, you can whack a ball against someone's arm, suddenly you're getting a penalty, whereas before it was never given. Your solution to this is one that segues rather nicely back into education and assessment, which is comparative judgment. And this reminds me a little bit of the last Inspired Minds I did with Harvey Whitehouse, when he talked about citizens' assemblies, in which you have problems that are so difficult to solve and you need to take politics out of it, that you bring experts in for guidance, but actually citizens sit together. It's almost like trying to find out what common sense is. Now, common sense is has been quite a politically weaponized notion, hasn't it? We've heard, I mean, William Hague, I think, when he was leader of the Conservative Party, said he wanted a common sense revolution, whatever that may mean. But we sort of do know what we mean. And your solution, or one of your solutions to the problem of VAR, is to try to work out actually what a foul is. Am I being right here? By basically getting hundreds of people to watch games of football and to say, that's wrong, and use that wisdom actually to understand what is a transgression, which could be used not just in VAR and sport, which is why I raise it, but also in education. It could be used to make judgments about what is the right thing to do for a society or a group.
Absolutely. So I talk about comparative judgment, using comparative judgment to help decide what a foul is. And I think there's three aspects to it that are important. So one is, as you say, wisdom of the crowds. Getting lots of people's opinions is really important. And I think one of the things that VAR has really alienated a lot of fans from football, if people feel like you're giving handballs that could never be handballs and just shouldn't be. And as you say, it feels opposed to any idea of common sense. So how do you get that common sense back in? But one of the things we know with common sense, it can be really hard to codify. So one of the things I talk about is tacit knowledge. Tacit knowledge is really interesting. A scientist and philosopher, Michael Polanyi, came up with this idea of tacit knowledge. So all the things that we know, but we find hard to express in words. And there are actually lots of incredibly important things that fall into that category. And one of the ones he talked about is facial recognition. So facial recognition is a classic example. We are unbelievably good at facial recognition, but try and explain to someone how they know that someone looks differently to someone else and you write it down. Would that guide be any good to someone who didn't have it? And he talks about other things, riding a bike, learning to float. You can come up with all these sort of maxims or bits of words and phrases that you could use. You just lie on your back and sort of stay still. And they're not actually, you know, they don't really capture what it is to be able to float. And he talks about lots of these. And I think common sense is sometimes in that category. It's all these things that we know what they are, but we can't quite explain why. And that happened a lot with handball, that you would see things where people are like, that's obviously not a handball. And yet, according to the letter of the law, the ball would have hit someone's hand. And they were like, you can't give that as a handball. So it would be some way of trying to get people's opinions, literally asking them, is this a handball or not? Well, you would try and codify that, but to try and codify it in a way, as I say, that was able to capture some of that common sense.
How precisely would you do that? What would be the mechanism for that?
So I'm not pretending it would be simple, but I think the problem you've got with VAR at the minute is it pretends to be in this great technological solution, but it isn't. It's just one guy reviewing it. And one of the things I say in the book, it's as though you were saying, if you go to the bank for a loan application, you put in your loan application. If the bank photocopy that loan application and fax it to another branch for another bank manager to look at, that's not a technological review system. You've just faxed it to the guy at the other branch. What we expect with a loan application is you have an algorithm that decides. You know, that's what I'm talking about, that you have some kind of system that is able to instantly make a decision. And VAR, it seems to me, is faxing it to the next branch. And what I'm talking about is, could you have more of an instant automated system that would make these judgments based on what humans have told it? And I'm not pretending it would be simple, but I think it's something we have to at least try and work towards. And so my thing would be, first of all, you'd need to take a bunch of video clips from you need a training set. So you need a training set of fouls, video clips of fouls from lots of matches. And then you get people to comparatively judge those fouls, those video clips. And I haven't talked a lot about comparative judgment here. Comparative judgment is my day job. We use it at the company I work for, No More Marking, to assess students' writing. It's a different way of assessing writing. It's different from the traditional way of assessment. The traditional way of assessment uses absolute judgment. It's where someone looks at one essay or one piece of writing or one thing in isolation and tries to put it on an absolute scale. Human beings are not very good at that. So the example I always give, I give an example with height. If someone walks into the room you're in and I ask you how tall that person is, that's an example of absolute judgment. If two people walk into the room you're in and I say, who's taller, the person on the left, the person on the right, that's a comparative judgment. And we're much better as humans at comparative judgment. My argument is, let's use comparative judgment to judge this collection of video clips. And let's get as many fans and managers and players involved in judging as possible. And then when you've done that, you would then have a collection of video clips. And they would all be sorted from 0, not a foul, to 100, definitely a foul. And then you have to decide where you put your line. And that's always going to be contentious. But you're going to have to draw a line somewhere and say things that fall on this side of the line are not fouls and things that fall on this side of the line are. The next step of then trying to apply it to a live match, that's where you would then have to have, in the live match, a video clip taken of the particular incident is then sent to the database of, I call it a foul measurement index, be sent to that, and it would be matched to see where it's most likely to fit on that scale. Now, that's something, you know, current technological capacity, you could have happen pretty quickly. You wouldn't want to automate it straight away. What you want it to do is to send the video ref a recommendation. So you would say, based on this incident that's just happened in a real live match, based on all the other hundreds of thousands of clips that we've analysed and measured, it sits here. So the recommendation would be, it's a foul, it's not a foul. So that would be my proposal. So I'm not pretending it's something you're going to do tomorrow, but I think it's a different way of thinking about these things.
Are we moving towards artificial intelligence refereeing? Because that seems to me that what you'd be doing, if you create a great big data bank, because what is artificial intelligence other than combing and sifting through what the sum total of human knowledge? What you're sort of saying here is that we could do this, couldn't we? Because we've got all these incidents. They're all very similar, really. It's very rare that you get a completely different one. You know, I suppose Vinnie Jones grabbing Paul Gascoigne, but look, that, I mean, that's in the data bank as well. So
there you go, exactly. Yeah.
Is that where you're coming from here? And do you see AI as being something that we're going to be using for this sort of thing and for indeed the assessment of pupils' writings and grades?
I think, yes, it is going that way. But I think the discussion with refereeing and education is quite similar because people talk a lot with education about robo teachers. And it's similar, you know, could you have a robo referee? Well, I don't think so, because the referee and the teacher are doing more than just making decisions. You know, they're also setting, you know, they're responsible for creating an environment in which the game can be played, responsible for in schools, create an environment in which students want to come and learn. And I wrote about this in my third book, Teachers versus Tech. I wrote about education technology and how technology tends to work is not by just replacing a human. What it tends to do is all of that human's jobs, it will replace some of those jobs. So currently, a referee is responsible for sort of managing the teams, making decisions, telling the players what the decisions are, being responsible for the consequences of those decisions, keeping the peace, a whole range of things. And it appears to me that making decisions is actually one slice of the job a referee does. Feels to me that that slice, they could get a lot more and a lot better support, probably eventually from some kind of artificial intelligence agent. But a lot of the other jobs, I think you still need them for. And I would say the same about teaching.
Your book concludes quite brilliantly. Your concluding chapter is absolutely superb. It raised a couple of questions, which I want to sort of finish off on, which is that having masterfully gone through all of the unintended byproducts of introducing technology to try to clear up things, it's ended up making things more opaque and more difficult in football, not so much in cricket and tennis, but definitely in football. I think that you're sliding towards saying there's nothing can be done. And then you give us a curveball and say, but it's got to be done. So we've got to sort it out one way or the other. So I've got to ask you, why? Why is it actually important? And I want you to sort of answer that by also explaining why sport is important, because I know it is to you, and the passion with which you write the book and the passion with which you finish that chapter clearly indicates that you're not happy. It's got to get sorted because this is one of the most pressing issues that is facing mankind as we speak.
Well, this is it. In the final chapter of my book, the final chapter is called Idolatry. So I do wrestle with the idea that it is idolatrous to think about sport this much. And not just idolatrous for me to be thinking about sport this much, but as a society, look at the multi-billion dollar circus that the English Premier League is. Look at the importance we all attach to sporting events when ultimately they're just fun, they're just sports. And yet in our society, we've given them this huge, you know, importance in terms of our culture and in terms of our economy. And so what I'm trying to do in that final chapter is just say, why are we, and I'm, as you say, particularly guilty of it, why are we all doing this? Why does it all matter? It is a great question. I'm not sure I do answer it in the book. Are there better things we could be spending our time and money and intellectual energies on? Quite possibly. But if you want to make the case the other way, sport probably is a part of what makes us human. Yeah, all the justifications people make for great art and culture, you can just as easily make those for sport. I think they're ways people come together. They're ways people build communities, build friendships. They're a source of meaning. So think about the world we're in at the minute. I think the reason why as well VAR has caused so much consternation is it probably is emblematic of wider issues about maybe remote and unaccountable authorities. And VAR is one of the main ways that people actually kind of interact, or one of the most high profile ways that people understand new technology and new ways of applying rules. So if you do have a crisis of legitimacy with it, actually arguably it is bigger than just a crisis of legitimacy within the sport. It's a crisis of legitimacy in the way that millions of people spend their spare time. So for all those reasons, I think it's important. But I think it's also important now and again we step back and recognise the absurdity of it being important. So that was the final chapter.
I think that's a great place to stop. The absurdity of what we take seriously and what is important. I mean, that's something that both of us have to wrestle with on a day-to-day basis.
I was going to say, Dan, you're making a living commentating on cricket, so.
Yeah, but that is pretty absurd, isn't it?
Yeah, so, you know, we've both got our idolatry, so yeah.
We've both got our idolatry. Daisy Christodoulou, thank you so much for joining us on Rathbones Inspired Minds.
Amazing. Absolutely loved it. Thanks, Dan.
You've been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my fabulous guest, Daisy Christodoulou. You can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms, and if you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series, now available on all podcast platforms and at rathbones.com.